the currency. It's too risky. I'm just doing my job, nothing personal. So I cost him a lot of money, and he would make a great deal more if I died. Of course, he could just wait a few years until everyone trusts cryptocurrency.
Why wouldn't you trust cryptocurrency? Asked Joyce.
But I guess he wants me out of the way now. I get it. He's young. He's impatient.
I'm not reading anything that suggests that cryptocurrency is going to collapse, says Joyce. Quite the opposite.
So we have to get to the big lad before he works out you're still alive, says Ron. Yes, or he will kill me, says Victor. And if I understand correctly, he will also kill Elizabeth.
Elizabeth nods. And he will kill Joyce. Joyce, who is currently trying to hide the fact that she is secretly feeding a piece of croissant to an adoring Alan.
This is certainly one of the most unusual meetings of the Thursday Murder Club, says Ibrahim. Am I to assume that I shouldn't be writing up the minutes of today's meeting?
I think that might be for the best, says Elizabeth.
What is the Thursday Murder Club? Asks Victor. I like the sound of it.
We meet up every Thursday, says Ibrahim, usually at 11 in the jigsaw room, but you are forgiven on this occasion, and we try to solve murders, though today seems to be about committing murders, so the remit is elastic.
What are you working on now? Asks Victor.
We were supposed to be talking about a news reporter called Bethany Waits. She was murdered in 2013.
I wondered, Ron, says Elizabeth, if it might be fun to take Victor with you the next time you see Jack Mason. See if Jack might open up.
He won't open up, says Ron. We've got everything we're going to get from him.
Well, who knows, says Elizabeth. And Victor, I also have a pile of paperwork for you to look through. Might as well set you to work while you're here.
I am at your service, says Victor.
But first things first, says Elizabeth, I need to send a photograph of your dead body to the Viking to prove I've killed you.
Excellent, says Victor. Let us dig a shallow grave and throw me in it.
And for a final touch, says Elizabeth, turning to Ron, I wonder if anybody knows a makeup artist who might be able to help us out. I don't suppose you're seeing Pauline today?
Yeah, says Ron, but without conviction. Probably going 10-pin bowling. Should probably head off, actually.
Elizabeth nods and wonders where Ron is really going.
Chapter 40. Ron wishes he was 10-pin bowling. Wishes he was anywhere but here. Pauline has persuaded Ron that he might like to have a massage. The air is scented with eucalyptus, heavy and warm, and it thrums and trills with the sounds of the rainforests. He is wrapped fairly insecurely in a thick white towel as he treads barefoot across Moroccan floor tiles beside an azure pool, and he is deeply anxious about how relaxed he is supposed to be feeling. To think he could be interviewing Jack Mason about the murder rather than going through this ordeal. Pauline had asked him if he liked massages, and Ron had told her that he had never had one, and Pauline had laughed, and Ron had told her no, he was serious. What would he want a massage for? And she said, to treat yourself, and then Ron laughed and said, if he was going to treat himself, he'd have a pint, and Pauline said, I'm taking you to a spa, and Ron said, not on your Nelly, not in a million years, and then Pauline kissed him and said, just try it once for me. And he said no. And then she kissed him again. And now, here they are.
Susie is the name of the woman. She came to meet Ron and Pauline at the front desk of Elm Grove Spa and Sanctuary and seems to be their gentle guide through this awful process. Apparently, aromatic herbal scrubs and Turkish cleansing rituals were real things that real people paid real money for. Every time Ron has walked past this spa before, he had just assumed it was a brothel. Neither spas nor brothels were of any interest to Ron. If someone wants to touch you, they had better be your doctor or your wife, or, at a push, a stranger next to you in the pub, wedding and score. Pauline holds his hand and tells him he can relax and that there is nothing to be worried about. Nothing to worry about. What if his towel slips? What if he's too heavy for the massage table? What if the masseur is a woman? What then? Or even worse, what if the masseur is a man? What will they make of his naked body? Do you keep the towel on? Do you have to turn over? Ron has seen himself in the mirror and wouldn't wish that on anyone. Will he have to make conversation? What do masseurs talk about? Can you talk about football, or is it all essential oils and wind chimes? As he feels the seaweed and burnt umber face mask melt into his skin, Ron prays for his torture to end. Are the gentle sounds of the rainforest ever going to stop? Ron reassures Pauline that he is relaxed and that worries are the furthest thing from his mind. He can't wait. Pauline laughs and tells him he will enjoy it when it gets going, and Ron tells her that he is sure he will. Susie pours them both a glass of deoxidizing watermelon juice and bids them sit on an avalanche of cushions, which Ron very much doubts he will ever be able to get up from.
So you're booked in for the 45-minute couples massage in the Java suite. Ricardo and Anton will be your masseurs.
Blokes, okay, maybe that's for the best. They'll get that this whole thing is weird, surely.
We'll start with the full body, then a gentle facial, and then a couple's steam bath to finish.
She is talking so quietly and calmly, it makes Ron want to fling himself out of a window. Except there are no windows. The walls are hung with ornate Persian throws and mirrors reflecting the soft, warm light of the scented candles. There is no escape. He is going to have to be touched and make conversation. He is going to have to relax, God help him.
Ron was once locked in the back of a police van with Arthur Scargill for 8 hours. And that was more relaxing than this. He takes a sip of his watermelon juice. It's actually not bad. Over protests that he is quite capable of getting up by himself, Pauline helps Ron up from the sofa. Susie leads them through to the Java suite. Two massage tables sit side by side, but no sign of Ricardo and Anton yet. Good news, the sounds of the rainforest have stopped. Bad news, they have been replaced by the sound of whale song.
If you lie face down on the beds, Anton and Ricardo will be with you presently. Namaste to you both.
Namaste, says Pauline. Thank you, grunts Ron, as he plants his face through the hole in the massage table and grimly hopes for the best.
You all right there, lover? Asks Pauline, as Susie leaves them alone.
Yeah, says Ron. I like the watermelon juice.
Anything you need?
No, nothing, says Ron. Except, are we supposed to talk to them, the massagers?
Can if you want, says Pauline. I usually just fall asleep. Land of Nod, dream of horses.
Okay, says Ron. One thing he knows he won't be doing is falling asleep. Absolute vigilance will be the key here.
Or just let your thoughts wander, says Pauline.
Let his thoughts wander. Wander where? Ron's thoughts don't do wandering. Whenever Ron is forced into actually doing some thinking, it's for a good reason. For example, what were the Tories up to today? Where did West Ham need to strengthen during the January transfer window? Why did they stop doing omelettes at the restaurant? He loves omelettes. Was there an egg shortage he hadn't heard about? or was somebody taking a liberty? Important stuff. And when his mind wasn't thinking about important things, it was doing nothing. Recharging for the next issue, which needed his attention. Wandering was never on the agenda. He looks over at Pauline, her eyes already shut.
You ever heard of a Karen Whitehead? Or a Robert Brown?
Just relax, Ronnie, she says, eyes still closed. He senses Anton and Ricardo glide into the room. He is thankful that the towel is around his waist. God knows what his backside looks like these days. A moon landscape. He hopes these lads are well paid. Do they have a union? He waits for a greeting, but it doesn't come. Just the feel of two warm, oiled hands on his shoulders. Okay, it seems the 45 minutes are starting right now. The hands draw long, deep strokes down his back. Ron reminds himself that at some point, the agony will end. Ricardo, or Anton, gets to work on Ron's neck and shoulders. Ron cannot avoid the fact that this is actually happening. Outside there will be cars and shops and dogs barking and mums shouting at kids, but in here just the terrible wail sounds. Maybe he should think about the Bethany Waits case. Perhaps that could use up some time. He hears Pauline sigh in deep satisfaction. That, at least, makes him happy. A hand is now drawing its way down his spine. Ricardo or Anton seem to be going about their business, and not, Ron will admit, without skill. Fair play. Perhaps they've seen worse than Ron in their time. The whales continue to sing, and actually, when you get used to it, it's not so bad. He read once that whales were lonely. He'll have a little think about Jack Mason, maybe. He likes him. Jack was always up to something, buying things, selling things, setting light to things. Now, here he is, years later, legitimate business, lovely big house, lorries going here, there and everywhere. Still, up to something? Of course, of course. How does he know Bethany is dead? Two hands start to pummel Ron's thigh now. He'll go and see Jack again, that's what he'll do. Take the KGB fella, talk about old times, buying and selling, all of them youngsters. Big house he has, Lenny. No, that's the brother fell through a warehouse roof and died years ago. When you think about it, have West Ham ever had a better captain than Mark Noble? When you really think about it, Billy Bonds, yeah. Bobby Moore, course, but Noble's in with a shout. He'll ask Jack. Jack'll know. Ron's swimming with the whales now, keeping them company. We all get lonely, son. Everything's going to be all right. Floating on the warm currents. Pulled by the tides like Bethany Waits. Poor Bethany. Who killed her all those years ago? Jack Mason knows all right. Jack Mason. Ron knew his brother. What was his name? Ronnie. It's his mum, waking him for school. Just a couple of more minutes, mum. I won't miss the bus, I promise. Ron feels so warm, cocooned. Maybe Jack Mason killed Bethany Waits himself. Ron doesn't buy it, though. Was it really the story that got Bethany Waits killed or something else? Something occurs to Ron in that moment. Something he's missed. Robert Brown? He knows that name. It's me, Ronnie. A hand is stroking his hair, and Ronnie opens his eyes. Has he died? He's fairly sure he's died. Had to come sooner or later. Good knock. You were sleeping, says Pauline. I told them not to do your front. You looked so peaceful.
Just resting my eyes, says Ron, his body singing a new tune. What's that feeling? There's something familiar in it from the old days. Ron tries to pinpoint it.
For 45 minutes, I know, lover, says Pauline, snoring like a little piglet. Now, shall we go to the steam room?
Ron turns his head
and sees Pauline smile. He has to catch a breath. You only get sent so many of those smiles in a lifetime. Ron reaches out a hand, and Pauline takes it. Ron realizes what the feeling is. He is not in pain. Not a single bit of his battered old body is nagging at him.
Thanks for persuading me to come, says Ron.
Told you you'd like it, says Pauline. Maybe we can do it again.
Never, says Ron, shaking his head. A man has his limits.
Let's see if you're still saying that after the steam room, says Pauline.
Ron levers himself off the massage table.
What had he been thinking about just before he woke up? He tries to get hold of it, but it's not there. No matter. If it's important, it'll come back to him.
Chapter 41.
But how do you murder someone in a prison? Asks Mike Waghorn.
Andrew Everton has done what he promised and made a few inquiries about Heather Garbutt. They are on the pier in Fairhaven, cups of tea in hand. Mike nods hello to a few excited passers-by.
Easier than you think, says Andrew Everton, trying to blow through the tiny hole in the lid of his cup. Though I've got the Home Office asking me the same questions now.
There was no CCTV. Someone going into her cell?
Mike is opening a skate park at 11 a.m, and Andrew Everton agreed to meet him beforehand. Mike is aware that not everybody has the chief constable at their beck and call. Perks of the job.
CCTV everywhere, says Andrew Everton. But the one we need has mysteriously gone missing. 2 hours of Heather Garbutt's landing just erased.
Jesus, says Mike. That sort of thing common?
Used to be more common, says Andrew Everton. But it still happens, a few quid in someone's pocket to erase the data.
But that suggests definitely murder, says Mike. That and the note she wrote.
You'd think so, agrees Andrew Everton.
It must be connected to Bethany, says Mike, waving to a woman on a mobility scooter.
Has to be, doesn't it? Heather Garbutt's about to get out of prison. She fears for her life, and then she's dead.
Honestly, says Andrew Everton, in prison, you never know. It's its own world. But put me on the spot and I'd say, yes, it has to be connected. That's not my official line. That's as a friend.
Appreciated, Andrew, says Mike. So catch whoever killed Heather Garbutt and maybe we catch whoever killed Bethany.
Maybe, says Andrew Everton. He watches a young man in a tracksuit idle his way along the pier, hands in deep pockets. Where's he off to this early in the morning? What's in those pockets of his? The end of the pier is a good place for a private meeting. Who's this lad meeting? Andrew misses being out in the streets, sometimes back in the thick of things, trusting his instincts. He likes being a politician, but he misses being a detective.
So, who could get access to her cell? Mike asks.
Warders, says Andrew Everton. We're looking into them. Other prisoners, if they're trusted.
Another prisoner could have murdered her.
Lot of murderers in prison, says Andrew Everton.
But to disable a CCTV as well, surely a prisoner couldn't do that.
Some prisoners are better connected than others, says Andrew Everton.
So another prisoner could just walk into her cell, pick up the knitting needles and...
Do you mind? Asks a man in decorator's overalls, holding out a phone. I wouldn't normally, but my mum's such a fan. Mike nods, then smiles for a selfie with the man.
I'll keep at it, Mike, says Andrew Everton. I promise.
The man in the overalls walks on towards the cafe. He stops to put a tin down by some ornate ironwork covered in peeling paint, begins scraping it away and rubbing it down. The boy in the tracksuit joins him, takes a brush from his deep pockets and starts painting. Andrew smiles to himself. Can't win 'em all. Talking of which,
I might, Andrew Everton hesitates, I might need a favour too, Mike. Only if you can.
Name it, says Mike. I don't really know very much about television, but it's just... I don't suppose you know anyone at Netflix. I keep sending them my books, but they haven't got back to me.
Chapter 42.
Throw a bit more earth over me, says Victor to Bogdan, just for warmth.
Victor, being a professional to his bones, has insisted on being buried naked. He knows that any self-respecting murderer would leave as few clues in the grave as possible. If they are to raise no suspicions with the Viking, then it is the right thing to do. He had waited until the last possible moment, of course, nicely wrapped up as he watched Bogdan dig the grave. Victor has seen many people dig many graves over the years, but few with the speed and efficiency of Bogdan. When this is all over, he wonders if Bogdan might like a job.
I could pour you a cup of tea, says Joyce, looking down on him over the lip of the grave, flask in hand, but I'm not sure how you drink it down there.
It's a kind offer, Joyce, says Victor, as another clod of earth from Bogdan's spade lands on his chest. Perhaps later.
Hold still, says Pauline, kneeling beside him with a brush and a palette of red and black goop.
She has been carefully painting a bullet hole on his forehead for 5 minutes or so.
Sorry to make you work on a naked man in a freezing hole, says Victor.
Pauline shrugs. I work in television, darling.
You smell lovely, though, says Victor. Eucalyptus.
Pauline had originally painted on the bullet wound in the comfort of Joyce's flat. The situation had been explained to her by Ron, and she had taken it in her stride. She had asked if what they were doing was illegal, and Elizabeth had said, define illegal, and that had been good enough for Pauline. She had also caked his face in powder, making him paler and paler, thinner and thinner, until they all agreed they were staring into the eyes of a ghost. They had then bundled Victor back into his familiar hold-all, and Bogdan had carried him out to a quad bike and driven him up to the woods. The others had followed at a discreet distance in the event that the Viking was somehow watching.
And we're done, says Pauline with a final flourish.
She gives Victor a last once-over, looking from every angle. You look terrible. It was Joyce who had spotted the original mistake. Pauline had first painted an entry wound on Victor's forehead. The recording heard by the Viking would leave him in no doubt that Elizabeth had shot Victor from behind, which is why Pauline was now kneeling beside him in a grave, turning an entry wound into an exit wound. If Pauline had been surprised at how accurately both Victor and Elizabeth could describe the exit wound of a bullet, it didn't show on her face. Ron and Bogdan help Pauline out of the hole, mainly Bogdan. Victor notices, but done in such a way as to make it look like Ron is doing most of the work. Victor sees the faces peering down at him. Bogdan is now throwing down more earth onto Victor's body. The idea is to give him a just-dug-up look. Ibrahim has his phone out and now trains it on Victor at the bottom of the hole.
Landscape or portrait?
Landscape, says Victor, is grittier.
Portrait, says Elizabeth. I'm taking the photo and I prefer portrait.
You are insufferable, Elizabeth, shouts Victor from the bottom of the hole.
Ibrahim has another question. Close-up of the face or the whole body?
Both, says Elizabeth, but not too close to the face, just in case.
Just in case what? Says Pauline. You zoom in all you like, Ibrahim. That's good work.
Yeah, zoom in, says Ron, and squeezes Pauline's hand.
Of course, we will need to talk about filters, says Ibrahim. Personally, I think Claridon would be perfect because of the earthy browns.
If it's not too much bother, says Victor, perhaps we discuss this after.
Ibrahim nods. Hypothermia. I understand completely. I also want to speak to you about Heather Garbutt's poem, but that can also wait until you are clothed. Victor looks up at the faces peering down. Elizabeth, his great love. How happy he is to spend a little more time with her. People drift in and out of your life, and when you are younger, you know you will see them again. But now, every old friend is a miracle. Ron and Pauline. They are holding hands now. Victor remembers Ron's name from many years ago. He was on a list. It was a long list, but he was on it. Someone at some point would have spoken to him, sounded him out, seen if he was sympathetic with the Soviet way. Meeting him now, Victor wouldn't fancy their chances. Bogdan, leaning on his spade, waiting patiently to fill the hole back in. Ibrahim trying to find the perfect angle. Joyce, his flatmate, his new protector, currently trying to stop Alan jumping into the hole. Looking up, Victor realizes just how lonely his penthouse is, how lonely his life has become. Young, beautiful people taking photos in a pool that everyone could see, but no one could visit. Where were his friends? Perhaps he could just stay here. Perhaps this photo would be enough to satisfy the Viking, and Victor can just change his name, leave his old world behind, and move down to Cooper's Chase. Nothing like lying in your grave with a bullet hole through your head to make you think about your life. Did he really need multi-billion-pound deals when there was Joyce and Elizabeth and Alan and a whole gang to be a part of? Perhaps they will solve this murder. Perhaps he can walk Alan through the woods. And Ron had mentioned snooker. Victor had no one to play snooker with anymore. He used to play with an old Kazakh who had a jeweler's in Sydenham, but he had died. And what, 3 years ago? He looks up at the faces above him once more. Maybe he just got lucky.
For God's sake, Victor, says Elizabeth, stop smiling and shut your eyes. You're dead.
I think I was dead, yes. I think I was.
Victor shuts his eyes and with some difficulty stops smiling.
Chapter 43. The others are warming up somewhere with cups of tea and blankets and gossip, but Ibrahim has work to do. He has Heather Garbutt's poem spread out in front of him. There is a secret in these pages, no doubt about that, a hidden message artfully concealed. Who was Heather Garbutt afraid of? Who was going to kill her? Deciphering Heather Garbutt's poem and discovering that secret will take some time. Ibrahim is sure of that. He had wanted to talk the whole thing through with somebody, but Elizabeth, Joyce, and Ron are not biting. They see it as a red herring. He even tried Victor after they had dug him up again. You don't get that senior in the KGB without knowing a few things about cryptography. But Victor had taken a look with dirt-stained fingers, then handed it back, saying, "No message here, just a poem." As so often, Ibrahim is a lone voice in the wilderness. So be it. That is his cross to bear. The prophet is often unheralded in his own land. There will be apologies aplenty when he uncovers Heather's message. He will nod magnanimously, head bowed a little perhaps, as the plaudits rain down on him. He imagines the scene. Elizabeth is congratulating him. I was quite wrong, quite wrong. Joyce is handing him a plate of biscuits while Alan sits in quiet, proud respect. Even Victor will have to admit that Ibrahim has bested him. He is lost in this reverie for a moment, and then the thought strikes him. Ibrahim knows exactly whom he should talk to. Someone who never judges him, someone who is always full of ideas, someone who will help. He looks at his watch. It is 4:30, which means that Ron's grandson, Kendrick, will be out of school, but won't yet be having his tea. The golden hour for any 8-year-old boy. Ibrahim FaceTimes Kendrick. He is remembering the happy time the two of them spent together, spooling through hours of CCTV, looking for a diamond thief and a murderer.
Uncle Ibrahim, says Kendrick, and bounces on his chair.
Are you quite well? Asks Ibrahim.
I am quite well, yes, confirms Kendrick.
Ibrahim outlines the task at hand. That there had been a murder a few years ago before Kendrick was born.
Not another one, Uncle Ibrahim.
And more recently, another murder in prison.
Millie Parker's mum is in prison. She was off school.
The lady in the prison, Heather Garbutt, not Millie Parker's mum, had left a poem which Ibrahim believes to be in code, a low, impressed whistle at this. And if Kendrick and he could decipher the code, they might find out just who had murdered her and the whereabouts of a great deal of money stolen in a VAT fraud. A brief sidebar here, as Ibrahim explains VAT, having to start Kendrick off with the basic principles of universal taxation. They are now hard at it. Ibrahim has a brandy and a cigar. Kendrick has an orange squash. It's less sugar, but you don't even know when you drink it. Ibrahim reads,
"My heart needs to reel like the eagles at wing. It wants to be heard like the blackbirds that sing. But my heart, she is broke, cleft in two, round the wheel. The eagle can't fly, still my heart needs to reel."
Well, you see why this is interesting, Kendrick. Terrifically bad, technically, but interesting. Her heart wishes to reel like an eagle, she says. Ibrahim has sent Kendrick a copy of the text, and he is reading it from his own copy. But two lines later, that heart is cleft in two, round the wheel.
There are golden eagles and bald eagles and black eagles, says Kendrick. They eat mice. Do you know any other kinds of eagle? I don't know any more.
A goshawk is a type of eagle, says Ibrahim, and Kendrick writes this down.
Now I know four eagles, says Kendrick.
If you break a heart around a wheel, says Ibrahim, and I'm just thinking aloud here, Kendrick, are we to take it that Heather Garbutt wants us to take an anagram of the word heart and combine it with another word for wheel?
Maybe, says Kendrick, maybe she might do.
Or, says Ibrahim, if it is cleft in two, perhaps she wants us to place a word for wheel within the two broken parts of heart?
Perhaps, nods Kendrick. She has messy handwriting, doesn't she?
I have good handwriting, but only if I concentrate.
We need another word for wheel, says Ibrahim. As a noun, we have disc, hoop, at a push, circle. As a verb,
a verb is a doing word, says Kendrick.
Quite so, agrees Ibrahim, which would give us rotate, revolve, and again circle. Such are the joys of the English language.
What's 100 times 100 times 100? Asked Kenrick.
1 million, says Ibrahim, with a puff on his cigar. Let's say that an anagram of heart is ath-er, and we add a word for wheel. I wonder would hoop work here. We fold ath-er around hoop, and we come up with the name ath-hooper. Not a name, Kendrick. And the word around can often signify the letter C in a cryptic crossword from the Latin circa.
The gladiators spoke in Latin, says Kendrick, and Julius Caesar.
So we add the C to the front of our answer. I wonder if you might search the name Kath Hooper for me and report back on anyone from either the Kent and Sussex area or anyone with links to organized crime.
Kendrick busies himself for a moment.
They're about 1,000. Give me the top 2, says Ibrahim.
Okay, says Kendrick. 1 is in Australia and 1 is dead.
Says Ibrahim again. The dead one. Did she die recently? Was she murdered?
Kendrick scrolls down his page. She died in 1871 in Aberdeen. Where's Aberdeen?
Scotland, says Ibrahim.
Maybe that's a clue?
Ibrahim continues to read the poem with the awful realization that perhaps it is just a poem.
Then he sees it. Did she write anything else? Asks Kendrick. Because this seems quite a hard one.
She wrote a note before she died, says Ibrahim, still looking over his new clue, testing it for strength.
A note?
A note. Yes, says Ibrahim, foretelling her death. But I don't think your granddad would want me to show you it.
Please, says Kendrick, I won't tell granddad.
I don't suppose it will do any harm, says Ibrahim. It'll keep Kendrick occupied for a few moments while he cracks the code. He finds Chris's original email and sends over the image of Heather Garbutt's note. He then returns to the matter at hand and begins to read out loud from the poem again. I recall as a child in the brook where we played, when our secrets were kept and our promises made, where the sun never ceased and the rain never fell, in the brook where we played, I remember it well. Where our secrets were kept, well, that's worth investigating. Repeat of brook, that suggests brooks, of course, and where the sun never ceased. Could that suggest the word sun without the N, so Sue, where they're looking for someone called Sue Brooks?
Kendrick, Google Sue Brooks. You played a trick on me, Uncle Ibrahim, says Kendrick.
A trick, says Ibrahim.
Sue Brooks. Sue Brooks. Was she one of Heather's fellow accountants, perhaps? A pseudonym?
Kendrick looks up from the note.
Well, the handwriting is different, isn't it? On the poem and on the note. The poem is so messy, and the note is so neat. So the note and the poem were written by different people.
Ibrahim looks back and forth between the note and the poem.
Yes, well, it couldn't have been much more obvious. Ibrahim was the only person who had seen both the note and the poem, but Ibrahim had seen things that were not there instead of seeing what was right in front of him. There was no secret message. There was just a lonely poem written by a woman who had given up hope, and a note warning of death, appealing to Connie Johnson, written by someone else entirely.
I'm glad you picked up on that, Kendrick, says Ibrahim. I knew you would.
It was just a test, I know, says Kendrick.
What did you want me to Google?
Ibrahim hears Kendrick's mum, Ron's daughter, Susie, calling him down for his tea. Sue Brooks, indeed. Ibrahim recognizes, not for the first time, that he is given to overcomplicating things at times.
No need to Google anything, and maybe we keep the handwriting between ourselves for now, suggests Ibrahim.
Great, like a secret, agrees Kendrick.
Bye, Uncle Ibrahim. I love you.
Kendrick's screen goes blank.
I love you too, says Ibrahim.
Kendrick was once again the right man for the job. If life ever seems too complicated, if you think no one can help, sometimes the right person to turn to is an 8-year-old. Heather Garbutt had written the poem. Of that there was little doubt. Connie had seen her write it, which meant that Heather Garbutt had not written the note. So who had? And why? Ibrahim will report his news to the gang immediately, though he might skip over a few details as to how his conclusion was reached. Chapter 44.
You happy? Asks Mike Waghorn. You look great.
Happy as I'll ever be, says Donna, eyeing herself in the studio monitor. She doesn't look bad. Pauline had insisted on coming in on her day off to do Donna's makeup.
2 minutes on this VT,
says the floor manager. Southeast Tonight is showing a report on a gluten-free bakery currently taking Folkestone by storm.
I'll say knife crime is on the up, Mike says to her. You'll say, it isn't as simple as that, Mike. I'll say, come off it. Don't give us that flannel. You'll say something reassuring, and then we'll play a VT of some people complaining in Fairhaven. Then I'll ask if you have a message for those people, and you'll say, don't have nightmares or whatever comes to mind. You really look great. Don't be nervous.
Thank you, says Donna. Is she nervous? She doesn't feel nervous. Should she be? She looks around the small studio, the floor manager with her clipboard, the camera operator on Tinder, Carwin, the producer, skulking, and, like a loyal hound, Chris sitting and watching. This time, he is giving her the thumbs up. She returns it. If he is unhappy at being usurped, he's not showing it. The floor manager has started a 10-second countdown. The camera operator reluctantly puts down her phone mid-flirt.
You got anywhere with the Heather Garbutt thing? Asks Mike in a whisper this time.
Trying, says Donna. Not really our case, but we've got a lead we're working on. Donna has spent all morning looking through the vehicle registrations from Juniper Court.
It's just, says Mike, I know. Says Donna, I know what Bethany Waits meant to you.
She was the real deal, says Mike. Have you looked into the floor manager cues the studio? Plenty of knives in a bakery, that's for sure, says Mike to camera, and plenty of knives on the streets of Kent too, but this is less a case of our daily bread and more a case of our daily dead. To talk us through our area's latest worrying knife crime statistics, I'm joined by PC Donna De Freitas from Fairhaven Police. PC De Freitas, knife crime is on the up?
Well, it isn't quite as simple as that, says Donna. It's,
oh, come off it, says Mike. Either knife crime is going up or it isn't. That seems pretty simple to me, and it'll seem pretty simple to Southeast Tonight viewers.
I wonder if you should give Southeast Tonight viewers a little more credit, says Donna.
and Mike gives her a little thumbs up out of shot. We have targeted knife crime in the last 6 months, thrown an awful lot of resources at it. That means more investigating and more reporting and more convictions. So obviously the numbers are up. But knife crime is vanishingly rare on the streets of Fairhaven or Maidstone or Folkestone. And by the way, next time I'm in Folkestone, I'll be visiting that bakery. Didn't it look delicious?
I'll join you, PC De Freitas. I'll join you, says Mike. Make you wish we had smell-o-vision.
And call me Donna, by the way, says Donna, then looks straight into camera. And that goes for everyone at home, too. I work for you.
First time on Southeast tonight, Donna, says Mike, but I suspect not the last. Let's see what the people of Fairhaven itself have to say about knife crime.
The VT begins. Mike wags his index finger in admiration.
You're good. You're good.
Thanks, Mike, says Donna. It's quite fun, isn't it? Chris approaches, crouching over as if he might otherwise be caught on camera.
Wow,
says Chris. You think? I do think. The bakery thing, the look into the camera. When did you plan all that? I didn't plan it, says Donna. I just felt it. 30 seconds on this VT, says the floor manager. Clear the floor, please. You're a natural, says Chris. Your mum just took a screenshot and sent it to me. People are much more impressed when you're on TV than when you're catching criminals, says Donna. You're good at both, says Chris.
And we're back on in 10, says the floor manager.
Carwin Price, the producer, approaches Donna. Brilliant. Just brilliant, says Carwin. You and me a little drink afterwards? Plans, I'm afraid, says Donna, and then berates herself for how apologetic she tried to sound. Donna gets a message on her phone. It is from Bogdan, watching her at home. She sneaks a peek as the studio count reaches 5. His text is 3 emojis. A star, a heart, a thumbs up. A heart, eh? The camera is just in time to catch Donna's beam. Chapter 45. The photo looks good. Very real. Viktor Ilyich dead and buried. Well, Viktor Ilyich buried, that much was for sure. The Viking is now using it as the lock screen on his phone. Could it have been faked? Of course it could. Everything could. Scratching his beard, the Viking remembers he was once introduced to Brad Pitt at a party in Silicon Valley. Brad had refused a selfie, saying, "It's a private party, just relax," or some such other Hollywood nonsense. So when he got home, the Viking photoshopped a picture of Brad and himself, Brad laughing uproariously at a joke he was telling. It's in his kitchen now, and if anyone were ever to visit him, they wouldn't know the difference. Meeting people, not meeting people, it's all the same these days. Reality is for civilians. As the Viking spies the building up ahead, he realizes that he has to stop being annoyed with Brad Pitt for a moment and concentrate on the matter at hand. He also feels shy being out and about and on the street. People look at him. He was born too big. He can't wait to get home again. The killing itself? It certainly sounded real to him as he sat listening far away in his library in Staffordshire. But why had Elizabeth Best thrown her phone away afterwards? It could just have been an admirable caution. Or Elizabeth and Victor could be playing him. Two old spies thinking they can take a newcomer for a ride. Sometimes the Viking lacks confidence in himself. He curses his imposter syndrome. The Viking looks up and sees the swimming pool suspended in the sky high above him. If you fired a rocket launcher at it, the whole structure would collapse and everyone would plunge to their deaths. Though no one is currently in it, so it would be a waste of a rocket. He thinks about firing a rocket launcher at Brad Pitt.
It's a private party, Brad. Just relax. Then kablamo. Maybe treat your friends with a bit of respect next time. But however tempting it is to kill people, it is also bad and difficult. Getting into the building is easy. The Viking has a client, a luxury car thief, on the 12th floor. The client sends the Viking money, and the Viking turns it into Bitcoin or whichever crypto is riding high that week, then sends it back to the client perfectly washed. It was more complicated than that, of course it was, otherwise everyone would do what the Viking was doing. But his genius was an algorithm that layered the transactions through the dark web, making his scheme virtually untraceable. In truth, it has proved completely untraceable thus far. The Viking says only virtually untraceable because he is a Swede, and Swedes never like to show off. His client base has grown and grown, and with it, his personal wealth. The Viking gets a cut of every deal, and the bigger and more complicated the deal, the bigger the cut he takes. 10 years ago, the Viking was working for an AI pornography startup in Palo Alto. Today, he is worth somewhere north of $3 billion. The Viking bypasses the 12th floor and takes the lift up to the penthouse level, to the former home of Viktor Ilyich. Anywhere you asked, Viktor was trusted, revered almost, a straight shooter in a spinning world. When he spoke, criminals listened, and when he gave advice, criminals took it, which is why the Viking needed him dead. Viktor always recommended laundering money the old-fashioned way, through real estate, through casinos, through smurfs and mules and shell companies, through gems or gold or through good bureau de change, which was very retro. It was all pretty safe, sure, but so time-consuming, and it cost lots of money, rather than investing in cryptocurrency, which actually made you money. Viktor is costing the Viking an awful lot of money. Sure, he's worth $3 billion, and that was probably enough to be getting on with, but Jeff Bezos is worth $200 billion, and the Viking doesn't like being $197 billion poorer than anyone. Viktor knows that the Viking exists and knows his business, but has no idea of his identity. Viktor's immense front door was bought from and installed by an Israeli technology company. The lock is unbreakable. Blockchain technology, graphene, and Kevlar, all with a choice of veneer. Viktor has gone for Alaskan teak. The company has done very nicely indeed, serving the security needs of international mafiosi, as the Viking knows very well, as it's his company. He lets himself in. He's there for reassurance. Elizabeth Best had been highly motivated to kill Viktor Ilyich. Threatening to kill a friend had been the masterstroke. But it is always worth checking these things, and Victor's apartment is close to the heliport at Battersea, so it's an easy trip for the Viking. After this, perhaps he will go for sushi, which is hard to come by in Staffordshire. There is a good place called Miso in Stoke, but the Viking is banned from there after he accidentally discharged a firearm in the bathroom. He is not good with guns, shouldn't have one, really. The Viking looks around the penthouse. It is nice, sure. Perhaps lacking a feminine touch. The view is very pleasant. There's the London Eye. There's Big Ben. There's the Bank of England. You could launch a rocket attack on any of them from Victor's balcony. Wouldn't that cause a stir? The Viking realizes he is thinking a lot about rocket attacks at the moment, mainly because he has just bought a rocket launcher. It was an impulse buy, because when you have as much money as he does, there are very few novelties left, and also because you can buy rocket launchers directly with Bitcoin.
So far, all he's done is blow up a barn. The Viking works out the geography of the shooting from the live audio he heard. He realizes that Elizabeth must have walked Victor through a large open archway to his right, then down the carpeted corridor and into the shower room. He traces these steps. No one has heard from Victor since the shooting, which bodes well. The rumour mill is suggesting he is dead. It is causing some panic in certain circles, which is lovely to see. The Viking walks into the shower room. It has been tidied up, of course it has. Elizabeth Best is a professional. At some point, someone with a bit of authority will notice that Victor is missing, and at that point the penthouse will be searched for clues. The Viking assumes that Elizabeth will not have left any. There will be no crimson blood spattered up the wall, no brains stuck in a plug hole. But there should be a bullet hole somewhere, maybe even the bullet. The Viking holds out an imaginary gun and points it at Victor's imaginary head. He pulls the trigger and estimates the path the bullet would have taken. It should really have passed straight through the shower screen, but it clearly hasn't. It should have lodged itself somewhere deep inside the Turkish marble wall tiles, but again, it clearly hasn't. The Viking knows that the bullet passed through Victor Iliad. He has seen evidence of the exit wound, so where is it? Is Elizabeth Best taller than Victor? Was she shooting downwards? The Viking looks lower, scanning the walls. Nothing. Was the gun angled upwards? Was that how spies killed you? The Viking raises his gaze, but still there is no bullet hole. As his eyes scan the mirror on the far wall, he spots it, the hole in the ceiling. The Viking looks up almost directly above the spot where he is standing, the spot where Elizabeth Best would have stood. A bullet hole. The bullet fired directly into the ceiling. The Viking stares at the hole. He recognizes that it means a number of things. It means, firstly, that Victor Iliad is not dead. The bullet he heard was fired into the ceiling, not into Victor Iliad, which further means that Elizabeth Best takes him for a fool. She has misunderstood his abilities. The Viking does not like that one bit. He sighs, because the most important thing it means is that he will now have to kill Victor Iliad himself, and of course, to punish Elizabeth, it means he will also have to kill Joyce Meadowcroft. Which is vexing. Most vexing. Chapter 46. Joyce. Joanna came down for lunch today with her man, the football chairman, and I, of course, have an ex-KGB colonel in my spare room, so I had some explaining to do. I'm only glad she wasn't here the other day when Victor was covered in mud. I know I have a power shower, but even that struggled. I explained that Victor was an old friend of Elizabeth and that he was staying temporarily while he was having work done in his flat. Joanna asked Victor where his flat was, and Victor replied that it was in Embassy Gardens, and Joanna said, "Is that the one with the swimming pool?" And Victor agreed that it was, and the football chairman, he is called Scott, said those places were worth millions, and Victor agreed again, and Joanna said, "So you're having a million-pound apartment done up, but you're staying with my mum," and Victor said he couldn't imagine a finer place to stay in all of England, and Joanna said, "Level with me, is something dodgy going on here?" And we admitted that yes, something dodgy was going on, and I showed Joanna the photo of Victor in his grave and said we would tell her all about it at lunch. Joanna turned to Scott and said, "Well, you can't say I didn't warn you.
She didn't used to be like this. Scott asked Victor which football team he supported, and Victor said Chelsea. So Scott said he knew people at Chelsea and could get Victor a special hospitality box to come and watch a game sometime, and Victor said not to worry, he already has one. I sent Joanna to the fridge on a pretext, and she clocked the almond milk straight away. She said I should really buy the low-sugar almond milk, but you could tell she thought it was a step in the right direction. Alan likes Scott, by the way, which I'm taking as a good sign, although thus far Alan has liked everyone. They've just left. Scott has a Porsche. He showed it to Victor, and Victor nodded in that way men do. Joanna took me aside and asked me if there was anything going on between me and Victor, and I told her there wasn't, and she gave me a look halfway between relief and disappointment. He is very lovely, Victor, very kind, but he's not my type. Jerry was my type. Bernard was my type. Perhaps another one will be along one day. He'd better get a move on, though. I'm nearly 78. Ibrahim had us all round to his last night. He showed us Heather Garbutt's poem, the one that Connie Johnson found, and he showed us the note that was not written by Heather Garbutt. So, who wrote it? I've persuaded Elizabeth to come on a little trip with me to Elstree, where Fiona Clements films Stop the Clock. You can get there on the train. Joanna knows someone who knows someone who knows someone. I'm hoping we might get the chance to say hello. And you know us, a chance is all we need. By the way, I'm reading Given in Evidence, one of the books by the Chief Constable. I only picked it up because there's a Hilary Mantel looming on my bedside table, and I didn't feel up to it yet. It is not at all bad. He really draws you in. Someone tries to murder the boss, Big Mick, in some gangland family in Glasgow, but the